I think that the first thing that we ought to do is decide, we have several different amendments and different things here in front of us, but what we ought to decide is, as everybody's proposing time and time again, is decide how far we want the bill to be, how inclusive, because I think how inclusive that you make it determines a little bit on what you're going to require from people. So I would, of course, think that to get to this, we probably should just open it up and let you start talking, and let you express your ideas on it so that we can come to some kind of consensus as to the type of bill that you feel you need. Tom, what are your thoughts?
Well, number one, I think we do need a bill, but this is a relatively new field for the legislature, at any rate, to be involved in. My personal preference, unless it can be demonstrated to me very strongly to the contrary, I feel that we ought, at least this first time around, to limit it to legislators and other statewide elected officials. I feel that we do want to bring it down eventually into other local governments or other levels of government, but this first time around, I'd prefer to see it kept legislators and statewide elected officials.
Well, and maybe also the regulatory.
Yeah, but the appointees,
regulatory.
Wally,
how do you feel? Well, Chairman, I express myself on the thing. I feel much like Senator Hartman does. I think eventually, if we can make it work, it should go all the way down. I don't think there's any justification for stopping totally with the state. Because we did have testimony to some of the great concerns were in the local level as well as the state level, perhaps even more. But my concern is that if we enact a bill that's unworkable and it fails, or it has some of the dire consequences that some of our witnesses have testified about what it will do to people serving on school boards and other things, I think we'll severely hurt government origin. So what I'm trying to search, and as I mentioned to you earlier, is if we want a milder bill and take it all the way down, fine. If we want a fairly stringent bill, I think we ought to limit it to the real politicians, the state level ones.
What are your feelings? If we spend months and months working on the bill, and the best of our ability to make sure that we had something that was in fact workable, then I'd say at this point, okay, let's take it all the way down. And I know we don't have that time. We probably will be in session another 6 weeks or so, and we have a good number of other bills yet. I think that we can, for those who want a higher salary level, and who on the state level,
I'm not so worried about the compensation paid. From the standpoint, I think there's potentially as much, but there is no compensation, where there is no compensation paid. But the real problem is the machinery to report this, no matter what we do, if we require a report, it's pretty complex. And for instance, I would prefer to have one central area rather than have every county clerk or city recorder be the focal point for this exposure. But if we can, and that's relatively easy to set up, but let's suppose we decide if we go all the way down, the county clerk or the city recorder becomes the repository or the repository for all these things. Do we do as state level normally does, which require extra work on them without providing compensation? Do we provide compensation? Do we provide some form of summarization, which I want to speak to later? Summarization is a very tricky word. How do we want to handle it? And I think we can make it work at the state level. If the city and the county, particularly if the county ordinance bill decides a good thing, by golly, they can go ahead and do it without waiting for it.
Do you think, Mr. Chairman, on an informal basis,
think that whatever we do as far as information is concerned, it's got to be where people can get at it or it's of no value. That's the only problem you would have with a central agency if you start talking about Amity or Adams or Antelope, and it's all down here at the Secretary of State's office. It's of relatively no value except a lot of work for a lot of people to fill it out. Well, the consensus is, it appears to me, anyway, if I'm not wrong, that you would rather work then on having it cover legislature, statewide offices, and state appointees, agency heads.
I'd like it to cover all aspects of state government.
All aspects.
And then we can start figuring out, by using some of the definitions in the bill, what elements of state government we want to operate.
How much of the appointed board that you want to cover?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, the point where you're talking about state employees of highway
departments. No, I like the new definition that they put in here from the model bill. Well, the employee of the state regulatory agency, and that's economic condition activity regulated by the agency by which it's employed. So that is somebody who sits on any sort of regulatory state agency must declare, even though he's a state employee and he's not elected and not appointed. The regulatory aspect,
so which one are we looking at?
Well, maybe the
15th version of noon, but it's going to be a common law bill.
Yeah,
April 15th.
Chairman, I was going to offer amendments after working on them last weekend, Glenn, but we decided to withhold them pending discussion of your bill, which is already ready, and I'd offer them in. I don't know how you want to do. Should we start? I think we ought to. Well, I don't know. We have the Attorney General's remodel draft. We have your remodel draft. Quite a bit of similarity, but there is some dissimilarity.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the thing to do is easily to resolve the differences and then get down to the technical aspects. You want to proceed on the common cause basis and have me offer my suggestions?
All right, now are you talking from the common cause original bill or
no,
the
no,
April
16th? No,
16?
No, 16.
All right, let's start with that one.
Chairman, if I may, the first thought came to me, recommended to me by a member of Common Cause who attended a number of meetings. We're back to the preamble, section one, and we were discussing the possibility the legislative assembly declares that public office is a public trust. And then he sees some negativism by saying in any effort to realize personal gains or official conduct is a violation of trust. And suggest maybe, particularly if we go to the disclosure direction we've been, that some language such as after public trust in line five and began, and that public disclosure of private interest is the best safeguard of the public trust. Might be a more positive statement if, in fact, we are going primarily to
public disclosure
of private interest, the best safeguard of public trust. We have tried to state all this in open meetings, and this one, and I'm sure in the lobby, in a positive sense, rather than making punitive and negative bills, try to make them positive.
Could you read that again, please?
And that public, it'd be line five after the word trust or after the and, the first and, the only and in line five. That public disclosure of private interest is the best safeguard of the public trust. And I have no particular pride of office, although I do think it's a better statement.
Our legal advisor will take your
Then, Mr. Chairman, just for purpose of discussion, the April 15th Common Cause Bill added agency. Turn at the bottom. I'd like to run it back up to the top. These are supportedly in alphabetical order, so it really should be number one, agency. And I've tried to continue the same broad categories. Now, if we, in fact, this is going to have to be changed. I do this on the idea it's going to go all the way down to all government, and this will have to be altered with clear language to indicate we're only talking about state agencies, if in fact that is our decision to stay at the state level. But what I did is I went back to New 14, which they put in on page 5, and try to pick up that language. And that's really to whom this bill is to apply, and that's using that language. Would read something to the effect of, well, I'll take it back, agency would mean every officer, board, commission, department, entity, branch, and agency of state government. And then I added, and every municipal corporation is defined in RFC 94-311-17. And that picked up all the rest of it. So I suppose if we decide to break it off at the state level, it would mean that agency means every officer, board, commission, department, institution, branch, or agency of state government, period. And that's actually taken from the ORS Chapter 190 definition. And then I misspoke myself. That's agencies and public officials. I stole from Section 14 of their modified bill and put it up in the definition of public official means any person who is elected to office by a vote of the people, 2 is appointed to office by an elected official, or 3 is an employee of any public regulatory agency and has an economic interest in the activity regulated by the agency by whom he is employed. And we want to make sure that's at the state level again, but that's all I try to do, is bring up Section 14 language and put it in the definition of public official.
Wally, I think they should be included in this, but on this business of Congress, and members of Congress, can we actually inquire them on this?
Well, we had a similar question in the Elections Committee on some limitations on other bills. The conclusion made, although I'm uneasy with it, is in fact to require them to report that they are, in fact, our elected officials. I think the problem comes in is I would recommend we try to keep the amount of formal down, and we try to, in elections, Secretary of State had a recommendation that, for instance, their campaign and expenditure reports, if they're similar to ours, or the same as ours, to use in lieu of making do it all again for our use. But that's not passed.
So we can't remove them from office. All we can do is request to Congress.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm not sure, Fred, but I think we, in fact, can require it.
On the business, why don't we take out the word 1,000, just leave holder of stock?
I would agree to that if we're going to go to the categorization.
If we go to that.
Yeah, I would agree. I have a parochial view, and Senator Bailey and I disagree with it. I'm just going to have to get more help on line 14. And any business which is a client of a person, that relates particularly to lawyers, but technically it relates to, I think,
PR
people. I think salesmen frequently refer to either customer or client. It does refer to others, but I think the goal is to shoot at the legal profession. The problem is, there are legal ethics opinions that throw that into doubt. True that Senator Bailey has reviewed the same material and comes to a different conclusion than I do, and I'm going to review it, but I've been always taught and told that the fact that that a particular person has retained me in a legal capacity is his business, it's closed, not my business. So there is a problem there. I think we can pick that up by putting, for instance, I think it's interesting that they say any business. Sometimes, if you go back to business, you come back in a business, by our definition, is self-employed individual. So if I represent a self-employed individual, I have to pick him up as a business. And if I represent an individual working for the state government, I don't have to pick him up. The conflict could exist either way. You think about it, the legal conflict. I won't push it at this point, but I do think that we can take that out and still get done what the disclosure aspects intend to get done, but not zeroing in on listing every one of your clients, which nobody else has to do. Except those who call clients. Maybe we have to start calling them customers, and then we would have to.
It'd be just a period then at the end of our holder of stock.
Yeah.
We went that route.
Yeah, we'll have
it. Senator Ripper suggested that the holder of stock would have a problem when you own shares in mutual funds. And you list all the shares and all.
Yeah.
You put one there when you got one here. Except for shares in mutual funds.
Yeah, but I think you ought to disclose if you own a mutual fund and what the category of mutual fund is. And then that changes from time to time, I suspect. So at least, I think ownership in a mutual fund might be close.
Yeah. You could write it the other way, say, including shares in mutual fund, but not the holders of the fund.
That's what, for instance,
you know, you own a piece of the rock, as they say in the advertising, you own a potential insurance company policy, and in fact, the money is making investments around the world.
Yeah.
And but frankly, it's a little strange for me to think that one of us would vote a particular way because of our life insurance policy, which money is invested in Prudential, which owns something else. Could be. But I think there would be other reasons for us to vote. A problem I have, and I want somebody to explain to me why, if they can, why on line 22, we exempted who receives compensation of $600 or more per month. We're talking about legislative employees. Is that, what was the theory there? There aren't many that are being paid under $600. They're really just the pages for the most part, and I suppose a few assistants. But most of all our people, I think the majority of them are being paid at least $600.
Can I ask, what was the theory on the... Well, I don't know if we're using anybody part-time, and the consultants are what, but I suppose we do, they would pay more than $600. I don't know that. I don't have a strong feeling for it either. And I suppose that if we don't hire the elevator operators or the other people, it just seems to me that drawing a distinction between being paid $550 and $600 as far as disclosure is concerned is not one that's justified. I think I would argue that if you're a legislative employee, perhaps you're going to file.
Some of the pages may have more influence than
some of the other legislators.
Well, then, by golly, I think we better remove that. Yeah. Let alone.
Let's take the 600 out.
Well, just so we put the period provided by the state, period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it means that all legislative employees would have to.
What would be wrong with saying instead of by a legislator, by saying change that to by the legislature?
Fine, that'd be better.
How does this affect interns?
Well, if they're paid, I think they'd have to report.
Interns I have, I don't get
it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's paid by the legislature.
Yeah.
So
okay.
If they get the stipend from the University of Oregon, they wouldn't be paid by the legislature.
We're going to put the period right after legislation.
From funds provided by the state, although. Yeah, let's put it.
Leave that in.
Yeah.
Somebody might have an individual.
Yeah.
I don't know who employs one at home, but somebody might have.
Well, what this does is the word employed is always kind of a. Can you affect the employed with no compensation? Normally, the answer is no, but they can avoid that. Moving on to what now is 8, old 7 now, 8 public official. Do we want to include members of Congress?
Like Mr. Chairman, I think they should fall under this too. The only question I had was whether or not, I can't imagine by taking the court, but whether or not it would be up to.
Maybe we could have Brandon check with the council mature, but I think the language they use, Mr. Chairman, in Kamikaze use section 14 would be a place to start. So that it means a public official means any person who, one, is elected to office by a vote of the people. We probably want to change that to statewide or higher off, statewide or U.S. Congress.
Statewide election.
State election.
Well, let's see. Well, I guess we're going to have to be more definitive, aren't we? We're going to have to be statewide.
That doesn't. It's like a congressman.
Well, statewide,
congressional, or elected to office in state government.
Adding statewide election.
Was there anybody who would not be covered by that?
Well, technically, the state
legislators really aren't elected at a statewide election.
No, but at the time of a statewide election.
Well, there are some cities that might
be
elected.
You can have public officials, we're leaving them out.
Public officials, so you mean the holders of statewide elective office, A, statewide elective office, B, members of Congress, C, members of the state legislature.
Right, might, yeah, or who is elected to office by the vote of the people to U.S. Senate or congressional office, statewide office, or office of the legislature. Then we want to pick up if appointed to office by an elected state official. Now, it is an employee of any state regulatory, you know, what I'm doing is paraphrasing.
Does that pleasure have to be in there? Because not all of them are appointed at his pleasure.
I took that out. That's
because some of them are there, and when he appoints them,
well,
they're there.
When this was drawn, I think there's three ways, and somebody spoke to this issue on the floor, and I'm hopeful that the interim committee or the committee on executive appointments will make a study. At the time, somebody talked about this, and it's 252 of there are a general, there's no sense to it. Some say it serves the place of the governor, some say it's removed only for cause, and some are silent. And we're having an argument right now, what's the one on, is that in the committee on the planning commissions, whether they ought to go out to local government, whether the planning commissions ought to serve the pleasure of the appointing official or not, and I point to the filibuster example. My problem is, I feel the other way around about it. I think that if they're regulatory or quasi-judicial, they should not be beholden to the person who appoints them. I think that's the independence we're trying to see. So I just avoided the whole issue who's appointed by office, period, or appointed to office by a statewide elected official or something to that effect. I don't want to see whether he serves his pleasure or not, because I think the critical areas are some where, in fact, the appointee does not serve at the pleasure of the governor. Those seem to be, and if we can continue that way, all the commodity advisory committees, the ones that are really advisory or liaison committees, I couldn't care less whether they serve at the pleasure of the governor. But the ones that actually make policy decisions, I think they ought to be sufficiently independent if they don't serve at the pleasure of the governor. So I just avoided that whole issue.
We'll just leave and serves at the pleasure of our office.
Yeah.
Who is appointed to his office by an elected public official.
Then as an employee of any public or this would be state regulatory agency and has economic interest in the activity regulated by the agency is federally employed.
Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm.
Now would this be like Bob Oliver?
Is he a regulatory agency?
Well, no, but I was thinking of your PC.
Yeah, he's appointed by
the government. Appointed by the government, but it didn't say office, it was recognized by the legislature, at least at this point. Part of the government's first step.
Well, we still have a point.
Would that be anything?
I think that's an awkward one because the legislature kind of reneged on making a decision whether we want it or don't want it.
Well, to carry that.
But I think that would probably be one of the most significant places to have a closure file.
And what about the Ed Branch group?
I would think not.
Well, how would you differentiate between Ed and Bob, who are both members of personal staff to governor, and neither one of them hold a position that's officially recognized by the legislature.
Well, they are recognized in the sense that we have budgeted for them.
We budgeted the legal counsel, though. We're playing at the present hand.
And we budgeted on the ombudsman. We budgeted a member of the governor's personal staff, and he has decided to designate one of that members of that staff as the ombudsman.
Well, I think we're dead then. I think we're going to have to lay down for something else because we'd wind up, in effect, picking up all these secretaries.
Yeah, that's another thing.
Because they're all, if Branfield is appointed, so is Garth Bailey.
Budget. They're really all. Because, like last time, we specifically cut the ombudsman out.
Yeah, but if we put him back in, then we lift him out, then we pick him up, in effect. Budget is asked.
Well, I think what the point Fred's making is that language is going to have to be tightened up a little bit.
indicate what kind of point of office we're talking. I suppose that we, I think maybe we ought to tighten it up.
And are we talking also about Jack Coleman?
Yeah.
Or Rich Kennedy?
Well, how about putting in management capacity or something like that? Would that take about?
Well, how far do you want to go?
Well, how far does it go? How far down is the Secretary of State, State Treasurer, Superintendent of Education? How far down before you get the classified? Is that what it is? Tom? Can I ask you, Tom?
How far down do you go in the Secretary of State's office, the State Treasurer, the Governor's office before you get the classified?
Classified, unclassified, that are there throughout, for example.
That would certainly change the governor's office, because the other people you're talking about are classified. But,
no.
But Branchfield is not classified.
Well, maybe Tom can help us on that.
They're quite a jumble of things in the example on classified services, but they like it.
Tom?
Is the governor's personal secretary, is she a classified?
Unclassified service.
So is all of the people over.
You've got a bunch of people in the unclassified service, 240-205.
Everybody over in the Supreme Court is unclassified too.
You know, that's the exempt service secretary that Tom brought over here says we might borrow some language from here. Exempt service, the idea of they're exempted here, but they're the ones that report on this. Officers elected by popular vote and persons appointed to fill vacancies in elective offices, statewide or state offices. That might be the way to get all of them. That might be. Members of boards and commissions and administrative heads required by law to be appointed by the governor. That's your first setup. Here's one. Judges, referees, receivers, court reporters, bailiffs, officers of court, jurors, and notary public. We might want to amend that a little bit. I don't know if we want notary public coming to mind.
Or jurors,
or officers of court, which is really every member of the organization bar, bailiffs, court reporters, and so on. That's interesting. Do we intend to include judges? That's something I've thought about.
I think the judges should be included.
Okay. I think what we're talking about would be we can make a choice. The Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, and Tax Court are all statewide offices.
And then you have the people running in the Circuit Court.
Then you have Circuit Court, District Court,
and
Court.
A Circuit Court judge, at least in my opinion, is on the same car with the candidate for legislature. And that brings up another question. What about the District Attorney? State office?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And he runs. I think those would all be caught up with
the language better be tight. They know it. They're not surprised by it. Okay, officers and employees in the legislative assembly, we got that. That's because a person is employed in a professional or scientific capacity to conduct a temporary or special inquiry, investigation, or examination at the legislative assembly. Or to be there on
the judicial branch is picked up in 7 or now in 8. That's including executive agents and the judicial branch.
Yeah, sure is. Well, I think then we are talking about how far down are we going on judges. We've gone down to the Circuit Court and District Court as well.
Let's just go down no further.
Just leave it at District, okay. And then pick up the DA.
Yeah. Did you get that? Mm-hmm.
Now, is there a... I'm not aware of it.
Is there enough JPs left?
Is there a definition accepted of regulatory agency without having to deal with the definition of what we mean by regulatory agency?
Let's see if we can find one. You may want to list by ORF agency. Let me ask this. How about hearing comps? I suppose that would be a good thing, too. Workman's comp?
Well, it might be very interesting to know whether they have any comps.
It'd be interesting if they... had a lot of shares in Weyerhaeuser.
I think
Weyerhaeuser is self-insured, so that would be a particular claim that they would pay it, right? Okay. So we're talking about the regulatory and judicial regulatory. The hearings officer are not part of the judicial branch. They're part of what the county court is going to be doing. I think some of the appointed officials are even more important to pick up than some of the unclassified officials. Now, the unclassified service gets into the ones we were talking about before. One executive officer and one secretary for each board or commission, the members of which are elected officers and appointed by the governor. The director of each department of state government, that's good. We accept the administrator described in Section 2. Employees in the governor's office, and the principal assistant, and private secretary, and the secretary of state's office. One secretary clerk for each judge who is in court of record. Oh, wow. The deans, professors, principals, instructors, and teachers, and facilities operated under ORS 346 Illinois. That must be the special school. But you wouldn't have deans.
345.
No, that must mean higher ed. The dean of the law school would be happy.
That's the other unclassified school. Lawyers employed in their professional capacity, licensed physicians and dentists employed part-time, student nurses, insurance, patients, or inmate health. All members of the Oregon State Police.
They just say that every man, woman, and child
is Oregon. Deputy superintendent, three associate superintendents, and one executive assistant department of education. Oh my. Temporary seasonal farm laborers engaged.
We're back to the 80,000 again.
But there is some good language here, Mr. Chairman, that I think that
we can pick it up.
Yeah, and they're getting, I think we've made a policy decision that we're talking about state government, the elected officials, and their immediate staff.
They'll make policy decisions. They're really important.
Well, primarily the temp service. Some of the selected ones out of the unclassified
list. But that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The exempt that make policy decisions. And that limits it down.
Yeah, but we're going to have to.
But I think maybe the thing to do, Mr. Chairman, maybe Grant could go through here and match it closely on a state level. So the original language is 14 by selecting the item out of here. And then I think we'll have covered everything we can think of at the state level. And on down to district judges, but not getting off that short of
them.
That's 240-195. Should we go on to the.
Yeah, let's move on with your next one.
Okay, yeah. Three is I just take out acceptance provided by law. So that's the. There's the trust. No public official will use his official position in office to obtain financial gains himself. Or any member of his household or any business which is a member of his household is associated. Now, except it's provided by law with the alternative get around, I think we all got a copy of the letter from Mr. Tarn. Raising the issue, those of us who are paid for service in state government, are we in violation of the law? Not an issue. You know, sure we might be. Do you have the language of that other than a salary and expenses of any authorized to such office?
Or that may have worked, other than a official salary and reimbursement of expenses.
Okay.
Did you have it?
Well, we have it. Other than an official salary and reimbursement of expenses. And on the end, over any member of his household or for any business which he or a member of his household is associated, or for any other person, you can probably put the person as defined in Section 2. Because when you say that, you're going to say no fair doing it for an association, a partnership, or a trade union, or whatever.
Now, Section 4, 5, and 6, I think, are presently in Oregon law, ORS 162.405, 162.415, and 162.425. What I would ask repeating it, having two sections, have Grant more closely parallel it than I have done it, and ascertain what, if anything, is not covered. Those are more comprehensive statutes to me, in my view. But 405, 415, and 425 of chapter 162.
405, 415,
mm-hmm. 425. The answer revised by the 1971 criminal law division code.
The major section.
405 and 6. It's the bribery section.
It's what's it? 405,
162.
Oh, chapter
405.
Then the other, on section 9, this is where we start with the question of what is he going to have to disclose his financial interest. And we'll pick it back up in 16, but I worry about the effect directly or indirectly, like his financial interest. Are those members of his household or business with which he's associated? He'll take the following action. I think what that's going to do is impede the open disclosure of potential areas of conflict. Indirect financial interest, how close must that be? Even the obvious, all of us voted to raise the per page cost of voter stamps from 10 to 50. Would it be necessary for each of us to file a statement as required by this that the nature of, and not everybody voted for it. Were those who voted for it, do they have a conflict, or only those who voted against it? Mm-hmm.
You're getting into the main problem in all of the bills that have come up, and the amendments and the other attorney general. The question of, you have two major questions. One, who is going to be covered, and two, how much you're going to get from them. But the other one is, how do you report it? And your question is, do you ask for each time any elected official and apparent or obvious conflict in file? And what does that mean? Or do you go the other way and say you have a report saying what those interests are, and that he can verbally say it, or if he's an agency person, put it in writing to the governor? There's more than one way of going at that. We address that, I think, somewhere in here. No, we didn't get down to it, but the question was raised earlier. And you could do it either way. You got a lot of you have him make some verbal thing, or to the president of the Senate, or the Secretary of State, or the Ethics Commission, if you're sitting with the Ethics Commission with Bill.
And this is a little loose language, and maybe it's too loose, and I'm not trying to fix the paragraph, but maybe if we put the emphasis not on trying to anticipate all the potential areas of conflict and send around copies to everybody. Much as you were suggesting, Grant, either having him declare prior to the vote taking or the decision being made or announced the potential area of conflict. I think most of us do that now. For legislative officers, and then the balance who are employed and not required to vote, so I'm thinking about all our employees, maybe having them in general broad categories inform the Secretary of the Senate publicly, or the Secretary of State, or somebody. We've got two categories of people. We have those who are called upon to make decisions,
mm-hmm.
publicly, judges and district attorneys and legislative officers, and legislators, hearings officers, and so on. They should declare, but they have an easy opportunity. They declare it prior to making the judgment. The other one's a little harder to get at, and maybe four is the way to get at it on page four. Signs the matter to another who does not have a potential conflict of interest.
This is what we're going to have.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Why would that?
why should we have a
Constitution says that you have to vote.
Yeah.
And the only way you can get excused is if you get unanimous
consent. And the real problem there is, if you get it done, you know, rather than walking off the floor, to avoid the tough decision, they just declare a conflict of interest and then sit back and not vote.
Easy way out.
I think it relates to the other side that you know, if you're talking about an indirect financial interest, not vote on a sales tax issue. Declare that you're going to buy food, things in Oregon, and I have an indirect conflict of interest, so I'm not going to vote on that one. That might have saved some of my colleagues.
Could have taken that dodge. So I
35%.
I think that's why it was taken out. Mm-hmm. Well, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to work on that. I think that one has real problems.
But
indirect financial interest is just so broad that that I've, you know, well,
I agree with you.
Extremely difficult. I think Section 11, as they've now amended it, is fine.
Now, the other question is that I could bring something back for the work session from Monday and go as far as the reading I got today on Wednesday. The question, the other one is the Hoodie report that you created, and that I can't go anywhere until we finish writing, so we decided one that we created a state ethics commission, which we're going to add to the next time out, or do we file with the county clerk, or the secretary.
Or the Secretary of State,
create an ethics
division
in his office, and
you can't
get
into
writing,
so
you get that
outcome. Mr. Chairman, I really see a lot of value in an ethics commission at the state level. I'm not sure about what the local level. If you don't go down to the local level in time, you don't pick up judges and district attorneys. I'm also, because I see the benefit of, we talked about the other night, making forms, I think advisory opinions would be extremely helpful. On the other hand, I'm aware that this is a weight and means problem, and we've been kind of wrestling with them so far, and maybe the two of you as service would be better at say. I'd like to see an ethics commission established, and I'd like to see
well,
them.
Well, we might be able to, a board like this wouldn't have to meet as often. We might be able to work out a budget that was only $30,000 or so. Probably get it through, but if we go to a full indexing and you know, all this sort of stuff, you'd be talking several people, but we might be able to get by with a board that would just be without an executive secretary, or without a, you know, to handle that as themselves on plan. I don't know, but we
well,
can find out. Let's,
I'd like
let's
to see
go ahead
an executive secretary for the simple reason that I think the functions that they perform are the mechanical ones of cataloging, indexing, making it available to citizen press. Then I think, but I think they also have a function of getting the forms together, trying to find out where the bugs are so they can report back to the 75. And that ought to be a part of it, setting up report back to the 74, even though the 75 section with recommendations and changes. And at least the power, maybe slowly, but there ought to be some funds in there so that they can make investigations at the basis of the complaint.
We get as high a buck on every statement that you issue. You know, I mean, if you put out each employee, each legislator, and the rest of them, so, you know, we want to have quite a few files in there. It might be able to make itself. You start talking employees, the least you talk is in this business is $15,000 a year for an executive secretary. That's 30. And it takes another secretary that's probably $4,000 or $5,000 a year. So
my initial reaction is getting negative reminds me of putting the ethics commission we could also make any fines they give, put back in their city. And fund them out of that, but that lacks really, in my view, maybe a super sense of the OJP court system where their activity was generated by their own salary, the more activity they created salary. And I think that is bad aspect. Well, certainly, we don't want the ethics commission to operate on that. Theory.
Or we could form a commission that operates through some existing agency that's an employee.
And that would get around to the next. And where the executive agency itself, I mean the agency, the board, would be on a per diem, which would be
relatively inexpensive.
Hey, just at the plant that gave me the, we have a bill in elections that is the fair campaign disclosure of fair campaign practices act. Suggestion, I mean, it was one way to think about it. Every commission that would handle campaign disclosures and reports, lobbying disclosures and reports, and conflict of interest disclosures and reports. Maybe that could be put separate division on the Secretary of State.
Yeah, and then if you put it on the Secretary of State, you could have this appointed board, ethics board, or whatever super board you want to call it, where you would have five members. All you would have is their per diem expenses, which is average of about $50 per person.
But not to have a meeting. You'd have to beef up the Secretary of State's budget.
But you'd have to have another clerk.
Yeah. I like that.
Which would be less expensive than if you set up a whole agency. Because then you have to set up an agency, you've got to start paying rent, and we now charge ourselves 50 cents square foot.
You know, that's for an office. This has a lot of merit. If the campaign is closed, the C&E could be then made not a, could be taken out of the election.
Yeah.
As itself and put in an edit to the university.
Which would make good sense because the C&E is one of the tinkers just got done right now when it doesn't have half of it.
I think I know what you're referring to.
Well, yeah,
we posted that issue on the phone.
Yeah, but there's also, I just discovered another one. One of the largest lobbyists of the whole world.
I think
it's in the
I think this would be a good suggestion. We might consider, for instance, the if that election still passes with a fair campaign practice of that, that could also be made an effective advisory committee to this.
Yeah. That would make more sense if we could find an existing one or a new one that's going to cover several different ones. Then we can justify the money a little better.
I hope you realize we're flying against the direction, swimming upstream in the direction that's going to take jobs away from the Secretary of State. We're giving one back.
Well, that's fine. But I do believe that the amount of work that this agency would have, you'd have to get something else with it to justify the expense.
I think that's a very good because I'm relatively confident we won't have a C&E campaign. We do have one already. Substantial part of the workload in the Secretary of State's office. If this bill passed, the lobbying bill, there'll be a lot of work for
one group.
Yeah. Thank you.
We'll hold up the Secretary of State's budget.
Don't tell my suggestion. Well, is that enough direction? I think that's enough.
All right, we'll go in that direction. And I would appreciate some other suggestions about who should all be inside. We do have the Secretary of State's budget.
Well, let's talk about the
C&E.
Lobbying
conflict of interest.
All right, and I would just hook on there. There's another bill, Senator Meeker and several others have introduced about campaign practices, which
find out what it is.
It's the Senate elections, it's kind of voting. Bobbing up and down. Yeah.
And there's one over in the House too on the C&E and something else over there. They have one too. Does something like this. So let's get to find out what happened to
them. Okay, well, I don't think we're shaped to begin writing something. I can probably get something back home tonight to get through part of it with the poll.
Well, could I just run through some else?
Yeah, okay. We'll let you run through this last one and we gotta go.
Okay, well, just quickly, and I'll leave these to Grant, but I think we can delete Section 12 because I think it's as it's now amended. It was narrowed by Common Cause in their April 16th, and I think now it's picked up by Section 4, which in turn is present already law. So when you check the 162 chapter, you might check it against Amendment 12. On 13, paragraph 4, starting line 8, other provisions of law notwithstanding.
Let's get rid of that.
Yeah, first I took that out. Then at last, if a candidate for elected office does not submit a statement of economic interest in accordance with requirements of the act, then 10 days his name cannot appear on the ballot. I originally took that out because we were affecting school boards and riot services, you know, the whole bag. And I thought that would just be an administrative nightmare to do it. But now that we're back up at state level, you might think about putting that back in.
Why can't we just tie that to present law about his financial statement?
Yeah. No. Okay.
So it has to go in with his C&E. And that one saved separate the wording and you would have it go in on the identical statement.
Okay, there's one other and that is the fact that you can you have a person not appearing on the ballot, but you have the question of the people who will be holding off time effective dates
And we have others is where they'll be holding off and what to do with them. The question is, one way to do it would be to say, shall receive no compensation for or exercise the powers of his office.
Don't we have a compensation statement from that?
You say, let's see.
I remember somewhere else we didn't.
Okay, in section 15, it's so right to say, public official to receive no compensation. So it seems to me it'd be better to say to receive no compensation or exercise the powers of the office.
Well, how about going to say
you've got to get the people that aren't salaries?
All right, that's good.
You get some more commission people. You know, we talk about $50 to $100 a month.
Okay.
And second day, $100.
We can go up to that far for Monday night, and then we can take on more on Monday night.
For the benefit of our advisory people here, can we kind of set a tentative schedule for the next time frame?
Okay.
Maybe Monday,
Wednesday, Friday at noon. Okay, let's do that. That's the only way we're going to get through here, unless we try to do another evening meeting, and I can't very well do it. Late in the evening, I'll start it for tonight.
Okay.
On Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and we'll meet next Monday noon.
Yep. And Monday evening.
Yeah, but Monday evening will probably be the full meeting.
Yeah. Well, you've got you, the landlady, and they're...
We're not going to meet together?
No, they have the house, and they're
not already to meet together.
They'll be working on lobbying and the open records, so you probably be a better office go ahead and meet Monday evening, and not skip Monday afternoon. And we meet Monday afternoon, Wednesday noon, Monday evening, Wednesday noon,
all right.
Friday telling.
Monday evening, we're going to meet, and
they'll be in charge.
Okay, fine. But anyway, you can go up to that far.
All right.
Now we start talking about what you're
going to do. I'll leave the
he wanted to testify when we first brought the bill up, but you were in Washington, wasn't it?
No.
And couldn't, so I said I would make a time when he got back to go ahead. So why don't you start in then?
I don't remember his name. 1963, 65, 67, 69, 71, that's 5 days. Each of those 5 times the table in the Senate today, sometimes in the hearing, sometimes we're not. I'm not here to try to persuade you of the desirability or need of a bill in this area. Probably you don't have testimony on that. Nor am I here to criticize or distinguish other bills that are before you. I want to talk a little bit about the approach that I took in the 5 previous sessions, and hope there may be some help to you. If on the other hand, you choose one of the other approaches that is before you, that's fine. The bill, I've had in for 5 sessions, as I said, we'll call it the hard time bill for the purpose of the evening. Cook Lunch will be the only sponsor present, so they're representative of the principal cook lunch last time. Essentially, there are 3 things. This is my, first of all, I noticed in my heart, in the last, essentially printing this typographical error, it's called conflict of interest. The bill was drafted in 1963, and at that point I wrote to a number of states and council state governments to try to find out what language had been in use in other states, particularly in states where there was a part-time legislation. Section 1 of the definition, I do not have any copies of the bill in front of me, so I have. Let me just talk about it.
All right, then we'll get it.
I'll leave my copy here. Section 1 of the definition of using this act, conflict of interest means a conflict of substantial private pecuniary interest in a member of the legislative assembly with official obligation on Section 2 is an effective preamble, which I consider important because it's a guide to the special committee that's set up under the act. You cannot, in statutory language, define all the conflicts that may arise. And so this Section 2, which I will not read, is a, well, I think you mentioned it. I essentially talk about the importance of a part-time legislator and the problems of recruitment and retention, and also the problems of making sure that there's effective protection of the public.
Why don't you read that part to us, Don? Because this is one of the areas that we're having some problems.
Okay, well, I commend this language, but I said, since my
lost off the humor. Hello, Tom. Hello, Tom. If you'd known I was here,
would you
have been here?
He just started.
I'll start over.
We need your help, Don, when it was open while he was back.
As I said, I'll say again for better than anyone. I sponsored this show in 1963, 65, 67, 69, and 71. And the table was that same thing that I was wearing for 5 minutes. And I said my mother's off. Criticizing any of the other approaches in the Navy before you, if you choose any of the others, that's fine. But the particular approach that I took, I wanted to explain to the Navy and help you. Section 1, which I just read off, the definition of using this act, conflict of interest means a conflict of a substantial private pecuniary interest of a member of a legislative assembly with an official obligation of duty to act. Substantial private pecuniary interest. All right, Section 2 is a preamble. I think the preamble is important because it's a guide to the commission that's established to, committees established to establish guidelines. Section 2 in a free society is essential that the people have faith in those who govern. Members of the legislative assembly, as well as other public officers, therefore must avoid conduct that violates or appears to violate the public trust. It is also essential to the operation of the lawmaking branch of government that there be a broad representation of occupational, professional, and economic interests. Problems of recruitment and retention on a part-time basis of qualified legislators from these various interests raise difficult questions in the area of conflict of private interest with public duty. Accordingly, the standards by which ethical conduct of members is to be judged in the legislative assembly must be established in a manner which will not unnecessarily or unreasonably impede the recruitment and retention of well-qualified members. Finally, it is essential for the public to recognize that the most effective protection against violation of the public trust with respect to conflict of interest in legislature is individual and collective integrity and good judgment in legislature. I'll give some thoughts of language, Mr. Chairman. All right, so Section 3, we talk about the duties of the members. And this must be thought of in the context of the unique requirements of the Oregon Constitution, which is that there must be a constitutional or absolute majority to pass the bill. And so, therefore, an abstention is not a neutral act. And an abstention is something that should be done probably not in every situation, but in some. But the key part of the section is disclosure. And essentially what my Section 3 provides is a compulsory disclosure and a permissive abstention. Section 3, during a session of the legislative assembly, a member must disclose the existence of any conflict of interest. Remember, I defined that above as being substantial, which he may have in any matter under consideration before a vote is taken on that matter, whether voting on the floor of the chamber or in committee. However, a member is not required to disclose the nature of the conflict in any case where such disclosure would be a violation of professional duties or obligations. This is a lawyer's problem, having to maintain the client's secret, but making clear that he does have a conflict. After disclosure of the existence of a conflict of interest, a member may request that he be allowed to abstain from voting on the matter under consideration. If the member makes such a request, it shall be granted. Now, this is different from the present. The present, of course, there's no requirement of disclosure, and there is the possibility of abstention only on motion. I think those of you here with me will remember me making these motions, and sometimes, and so far, they've been granted. And of course, they need not be. All right, then.
At that point, Don, do you think that it should be a unanimous decision, or would it be just one member not allowing you to abstain?
No, my suggested bill says that each individual member who requests the abstention has the abstention as a matter of right. That's different from the president.
What if you were to take a very critical bill like the tax bill where one vote makes a difference?
I think, well, this is tied in part to Section 5 when it comes to the establishment guidelines, but I think that the abstention for a substantial private pecuniary interest conflict should be a matter of right.
We had one member who had tremendous real estate holdings who disclosed that he would make terrific gains. Yet on that tax bill, it took two people. I mean, it took a bi-party thing where any abstention was null. You might have been able, many of us might have been able to use that to get out of voting on something that you really didn't want to vote on.
Well, when you say use it, of course, maybe let me go on and talk about what I've done in Section 4 and 5.
Okay.
My proposal is compulsory disclosure of a substantial conflict, as I define, and permissive abstention. But the permissive is with the member himself, subject to the guideline, which I'm about to talk about,
okay,
as a right. All right, section four, and this language I've been copying some of the other bills that have been put in recent sessions. They created a joint special committee on ethical conduct. The members reflected as follows. President Senate shall appoint two senators who shall not be the same political party. The Speaker of the House of Representatives shall appoint two representatives who shall not be the same political party. The government shall appoint one member. Section five, the joint special committee on ethical conduct established under section four of this act shall function during the session of legislative assembly. A. To establish guidelines for ethical conduct in legislative assembly. B. To issue advisory opinions concerning ethical conduct and possible conflict of interest upon the request of a member of the legislative assembly. Let me stop there. I don't think you can define by statute all of the distinctions between what is a substantial conflict and what is not. When they raise the dues, the lawyers, the Oregon State Bar, $10. Is that a conflict for lawyers? Yes, but substantial, no. My favorite illustration is the one that happened to me in my first session in the Senate. We were as a private attorney. I had represented before the session started. I had represented a client who was suing the State Board of Landscape Architects for a denial of his license, and while I was there, I was challenging the constitutionality of the Senate. In that session, the President of the Senate was referring the budget bill to the Senate committee. So the budget of the Board of Landscape Architects came to the Committee on Planning and Development, which I served. Before me, as a committee member, came the people I was suing their individual names, requesting approval of the budget. In their budget was an itemized legal defense, and they only had one suit they were defending. I felt that was the proper one to have six. As each of you know, I might expect a lot. I have disclosed routinely and abstained occasionally. And I've abstained on issues where it seemed the conflict was very great. I disclosed it in each place. Each year I have abstained maybe once or twice. But if you give the special committee the authority to establish the guidelines, then you can develop kind of a code of conduct which will make clear to see when it is a sufficient importance for saying when not. I emphasize the importance of B, advisory opinion. Oregon State Bar does it when lawyers have a situation where it's a question of whether we can represent a client. Often a lawyer in a small town has a problem where there may be a conflict, it may represent some kind of situation. A lawyer can go to the Oregon State Bar Committee on Legal Ethics and request an advisory opinion. Is this something you can do or something you cannot? Is the situation not only clear? Then these advisory opinions become kind of a body of case law. So between the guidelines and the advisory opinions, after a while it becomes clear when there should be a disclosure, when there should be an extension. All right, then the Joint Special Committee on its own motion, motion that a member of the legislature shall investigate complaints, hold hearings, report findings, the power of censor, power recommend censor, and the House, each House has the authority to censor. I gave thought to having a more severe penalty, but I think the power of censor, a fairly minimal penalty, probably sufficient. That has certainly been the experience of the U.S. Congress, where when Senator McCarthy or Senator Dodd were censured, they that did the trick. But essentially, what I'm suggesting is the ingredient for the minimum bill, and if you prefer one of the other bills, great. But the minimum bill that I suggested, a definition, which makes it required to be substantial, a preamble, which lists the purpose, which provides some guidelines, compulsory disclosure for missing attention, the Joint Committee for guidelines, for advisory opinions, and the ability to hold hearings and recommend censure and the authority of the House and the we call it the Carson Bill often. The Carson, well, the moment it's the Carson Harkin Bill.
Right. Oh, you know, it's not
Are there questions for Don?
Well, I'm embarrassed, Chairman. I should have thought of it a long time ago. We really need help.
Here's the language.
If you remember this, it's kind of a conflict of interest. Trouble, Don, I think I perceive the will of the voters and the people, and for a time that perhaps this bill was too strong, I think its major criticism now is it's perhaps too weak.
I have no objection to a stronger bill.
Oh, okay.
As I said before he came, I'm not here differentiating this bill from others. This is an approach that's being useful to me in creating a session. If you want to have a stronger bill, do it with my support.
Thank you.
I urge you, in any bill you pass, to face up a peculiar Oregon problem and not sit in the yard. Difficult problem to explain somebody
not to make. Well, Don, I commented earlier one time that because of this majority requirement, the easiest way to take a walk is to declare conflict, which excuses you from voting. The hardest thing to do in the Senate is to vote, really give you commands and do these things. The voting really counts. We've not seen abuse, mainly because most people are now objecting to the opportunity to abstain. In fact, there's been one abstention that was in Bill 80 by Senator Rowan, I think, in the 5 months. Yeah, that's right, Wingard, I'm getting two. But Wingard's no vote could be equivalent to where it was supposed to be anyway. So, you know, what I worry about is the abstention route. It's not been abused in the past, and I have no reason to think it will be abused in the future. But 1967, when I first got the House, it started to be a kind of a common thing. Every time somebody bumped against a tax question, a conflict of interest. So you decide, well, I'd really rather not vote on this, I'll declare a conflict of interest. Staff handful, if you recall, put an end to that, because you objected. Yeah, I know, but I've never spent quite a bit of thorough on that time. I agree with you that the substantial pecuniary interest is really easy with our citizens, legislators. We still are.
I want you to know, Santa Carlos, the citizen. I appreciate you guys, Daniel. You're always here and see you next year.
Yeah. Particularly as a citizen, you appreciate it.
In the Senate, since 63, I would say abstentions have been attempted 2 or 3 times session by the engagement about it. Never opposed, and you will. Now, in this landscape architect situation I just gave you, how could I possibly vote about that? In other words, there are many times that I spoke. I've got a situation, well, I'm chairman of the Senate Environmental Affairs Committee and chairman of the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers. And in a bill before us involving the Boise Cascade Notice, that was smelling on the way down.
I apologize for that.
The only people who came out of the committee meeting were my clients. So I had no peculiar interest. I spoke because of the appearance of interest. I did not attend.
Well, I think this is a problem peculiar to the legislature. In our system of voting, and that every time somebody isn't there, you have an automatic no. And I'm afraid that you would have some real conflict with the other members if 3 or 4 of them decided to abstain.
Well, if you establish guidelines.
If you had close bills.
If you establish guidelines, what I'm suggesting is you cannot define by statute in precise detail what might occur. But with a commission and body of case law, you'll have a situation where it's known when you can.
Go ahead. I could see some problems. I'm thinking about one particular member who has enough investments that once you start to list all the conflicts, his property, stocks, and a dozen, maybe 25 or 30 different, and major amounts of stock. When you got through, you made a list. This man could have almost anything that came up. Could be a substantial conflict. Maybe not in his standards, but by some of our standards, it would be.
Well, I think the joint committee, should address itself with situation. Now, the example I gave you before, my first abstention, was an example where more than any other person in the state of Oregon, I had a conflict.
Yeah, so go ahead.
Don, you and I, and Tom, and other extraordinary minds agreed in 71 that this is the way to go for the legislature. For us, the bill before us tonight speaks more. In fact, we ran into a little fire because we limited it to really statewide offices with judiciary and district attorney, avoiding, because of, in my view, the mechanical difficulties of going into counties and school districts and cities and special districts. Your bill fits only the legislature. And there are some substantial differences that we'll talk about later tonight, I think, between the responsibility of a judge, a full-time judge as opposed to a part-time legislator. I agree with your bill and
your bill there.
Our bill. I think this does answer the problem of the legislature. But I really think we need to go further when we're talking about, and I think, really, as a matter of fact, Mr. Chairman, I think that the definition of conflict of interest here is a good one. The substantial, I've forgotten, which I think is an improvement. I think we need some help on the preamble, and we received some very Carpenter and perhaps others that will provide assistance. I think it's just a good.
Let me say again, I am not here trying to undercut any other bill. If you want to pass a stronger bill, you'll have my support. Tell them I'm approaching that taking a brief session. If you want to extend this in relevant ways, another public opinion, I agree. I think the problem is a little different. I'm not sure the same bill can blanket a legislator whether it like full time public special or blanket and a part time unpaid school. I think the problem comes in that it's just everybody. Instead of Mr. Chairman, from any help to you, it's an area that I've led you guys for over the years, and I'd be glad to be assisting to your community clerk or council on doing the language problem.
We're going to need it, though. We do need this definition for sure. I think that we do have to, Wally and I disagree sometimes on preamble.
I'm anti-preamble.
He's anti, but I do think in a major such as this that the intent of it's going to have to be expressed so well because it is such a large limbo area in a sense. In fact, I have difficulty trying to write definitions or think of definitions. And when you start this, you just get one, and then that just opens up 20 more, and you just can't write 100 definitions for who is and isn't. And it's going to have to be taken almost on a case-by-case basis whenever you get to this ethics commission.
Well, I can tell it came in experience the unsafe bar from any legal ethics, which over a period of many years has written so many opinions, meticulously, month by month, they come out, and after a while, the kind of parameters of what's proper and what's not.
Mr. Chairman, let me share with Don. I tried to make this point in the group that I really feel that the settlement establishing an ethics commission would be the benefit of the public official as opposed to the detriment, because he would have the guidelines and would be able to go to some place and say, is this a potential area of conflict? So you get a ruling, and then he could operate within the parameter of the ethics commission, which if somebody took a shot at him, he could say, well, I did ask.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the interesting thing is Lance made a suggestion in our new meeting that we, because we're now encompassing statewide officials as opposed to the legislature, that we establish a division within the Secretary of State that would pick up really the monitoring of ethics, campaign expenditures and contributions, lobbying, and I added, although that's not a common, those three are a major emphasis on the cause, what we call fair campaign practices. And put that in special, Grant and I were talking about
fair practices.
What is it?
Fair practice.
Fair practices division in the Secretary of State. And its major function would be to provide guidelines, provide opinions, that for the first time, a candidate running for office would have a guideline on how he's supposed to operate rather than flying blind and running into problems later. So,
well,
yeah, I sure hope you're available.
In terms of, you might give thought of a legislator. Aspect of this to have legislators participating in the advisory opinion. I really thought that out. That was my thinking, the old thing, 10-year-old thinking. My thought was that it would be more credible in legislators than others that were in the same position. They were hopefully a little well respected senior members. I wish we had a comptroller as we program it.
Been through this and indicated the affectionate too, and I we meet. We do meet during the noon hour at times. I would like to have Don join us.
We're meeting again Wednesday noon.
Well, just tell the judge.
Either is that what
I'll be glad I'm just going to be out by my hand.
Which leads us back to the question of the of an ethics committee. We ought to be thinking about what kind of makeup that we would. If you are going to use the city, it's going to take somebody that's going to understand it. And certainly ought to have a judge to
I don't disagree.
You don't think that there should be somebody from the court of appeals?
I don't think anybody that comes under the purview of the law should sit on that court.
I'm not sure if legislators ought to be sitting in judgment themselves.
Well, my point is, if you have if conflict of interest means anything, he's going to abstain from the discussion that relates to his own office. Therefore, the judge is not going to be able to render any kind of a. In other words, the argument usually is expertise, conflict of interest. And if he is a member of the ethics committee and exercising it properly, he will abstain and refuse to participate in the discussion of the judiciary, which he got him on there because he's got the expertise. So don't put it on. Now, former judges or to be judges,
former legislators,
there is such a list.
Former legislators.
In fact, I think former legislators would be there. I think Don Wilman would be a beautiful example of a guy that would do a great job. But I think if he's serving in any one of the main capacities, he could not serve as one of the other advisory committees or whatever we want to call it.
Now, you were going through your bill. You were suggested the other day, and we left off at the
Can I have my bill, man?
Oh, yes, sir. Yeah. Do you remember where we left off?
Here. Right. Well, Mr. Chairman, when we left off in the last episode, listeners will recall that Pauline was precipitously hanging over the bridge. We've gone through most of the definitions, and where do you want to start, Brent?
Well, it would probably be the easiest to, when we finished last week, I said that I would, on Friday, would try to give us something back tonight in cleaner shape than what we've been marking up, but we didn't get enough done, frankly, to begin to pull anything into focus. Fortunately, Loretta gave us a really sharp note from the meeting, and I've got my bill marked up. I think you've all got ours, so I think you know what we got through. A number of things
you,
did not catch up.
You people that are interested, if you'd like to come up here, there's lots of chairs here. If you'd like to get a little closer where you can hear, why just come up and set if you'd like. But with a mighty big room, you might want to get close.
As we went through the bill last week, just really briefly to run us up, we reworked the preamble to say that on line 5 after and the public disclosure of private interest is the best safeguard of the public trust. In section 2, we took and moved agency, the definition of agency, up to number 1 and reworked that to include, not as it's written there, but as Senator Carson had it,
every officer, board, commission, department, institution, branch, or agency of the state government.
Right. We left business the same. Business with which we associated, we ended on line 13 after employee. Left open is the question of stock, which we decided we'd take up farther along. We got to reports of income and holding.
Okay. Let me interrupt. One of the decisions we've been trying to contrast, one of the key decisions we'll have to make is disclosure or reporting of conflict versus the prohibition of conflict. And this bill, as we're now working on it, is primarily disclosure. We'll move very gingerly in the area of prohibition of conflict. The problem is, as Senator Wilner talked about abstentions and some of the others, but this is basically, as we're now talking about it, a disclosure bill, leaving censure or fine or penalty will come to, but the idea now is to get
the information out front first. And primarily, I think my judgment is because of the difficulty in assessing what constitutes a conflict of interest. And John Wellner spoke to that.
Okay. We left candidates to stand. The fourth commission would have to be rewritten to be some sort of division, legislative employee, and it on line 24 after funds provided by the state. Person, public official, remain the same.
Well, public official is
bottom. Would be
the information that we picked up.
Well, right. We would include, that is, it would not remain the same. Would be include the members of Congress and the judicial branch, including district attorneys, circuit and district judges, the heads of state agencies, and the exempt personnel, certain exempt personnel, which I've not gotten together for you yet, but I've got an idea to bring you back on Wednesday or Friday to get that one straight.
You might clip out about the fourth paragraph of Larry Rowley's article on Friday night or whatever it was, where you defined what we talked about. Was pretty.
Put that back in there.
Later down. So.
All right. Section 3 struck, except as provided by law, the last part of that, and was to be amended to say that you could, in fact, draw your salary and be reimbursed for expenses. Then I think Senator Carson had some remarks on sections 4, 5, and 6. You had me go to the ORS, and you have a copy here of under abuse of public office, 162, 405, 415, and the right top right hand column 425, which parallel much of, not exactly, but and speak to the same intent of sections 4, 5, and 6.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I've made the judgment that sections 4, 5, and 6 really are ORS 162, 405, 415, and 425, which was amended substantially by the Criminalization Commission in 1971. And I would ask that, and I did ask Fran, and he will, and I didn't invite anybody else to compare the two, and if we've missed somebody, I think from a statutory construction standpoint, it would be much better to amend ORS 162 to include the elements rather than to have two overlapping statutes speaking to the same crime, which is a difficult area. So if we have, in fact, by deleting sections 4, 5, and 6, and in my view also deleting section 12, created a gap that is not covered by 405, 415, and 425, I'd be delighted to entertain a motion or a suggestion that we amend those sections rather than having two sections speak to the same crime, providing different penalties and different elements of proof and the whole thing. It's not very sound way. So my suggestion is to delete 4, 5, and 6.
If you would rather, when I bring that clean bill back, whether we should have that in or out, some direction would be definitely worthwhile in that area.
Well, if they're already long, you don't have to worry about it.
Speaking to statewide offices, we're speaking to legislature, we're speaking to judicial district attorneys. And I wonder whether that ought to really be a rule of the body. And I would vote with you on that. I believe you. But we're trying to write a general law that affects the legislature, judiciary, executive. And the executive, I don't know what difference it would make whether he had it or not. Funds or anything.
Yes. I was thinking the new aspect of legislative session would be relatively short.
I agree, it's duration.
And that it is highly action oriented. I think we're somewhat out of a class by itself.
The trouble is all the fundraising dates and Lincoln's birthday and all these different ones all fall in the same period. If you go to annual legislation, you're going to really
know. I don't know why you picked Lincoln. We're not have a fundraiser this year. So far, we can go 100% for this. We've not had a fundraiser.
Yeah.
But if the session goes on to the 4th of July, then maybe we'll be coming too.
Somebody has a birthday.
Well, I've got a good point, and the minority leader in the Senate for two sessions has urged that something be done to stop this. I don't want to be in a position of one of our colleagues is automatically making light of it. It's a very serious question. I agree wholeheartedly with Earl that we should not have fundraisers during the session because it is purely legislative, and the appearance of, but won't you buy a ticket, and by the way, your bill is pending before my committee, is not good for anybody. The question I'm asking is whether I'll be expanding or I'll be by rule. I have no objection if we want to put it in statute, but I'm not sure if this is the bill for it.
Can I
Yeah, sure. We're very jealous over at least the one big, and I've heard rumors of the size of that one is kind of closing the barn door. But nevertheless, I would agree basically with your philosophy.
My only concern about race is now in three separate bills. Everybody says, don't belong here, it's a good idea. But both houses now have passed campaign, at least sent to the floor, campaign spending limitations, and it wasn't deemed to be appropriate to be included there. The lobbying bill probably isn't appropriate. It seems to me that it kind of zeroes in on Section 5 of this bill. You're getting close to it. And it definitely speaks to a concept of interest.
How about you and me offering amendments to the House rules? Although I realize how little fidgety about rules can be, but you might get 31 votes for it. Offering rule changes this session right now. And I realize that Eric and I talked that it's no comfort to common cause to have it in the House rules or Senate rules. But I think this is a peculiar thing that you deal with about the line. And I'm sure it's kind of the river jungle in offering an amendment to rules. Mr. Chairman, Earl's got a good point. He's on the mark. And I know how he feels when he gets shunted from bill to bill to bill to bill, saying, well, good idea, Earl, and he does come back in the next millennium and we'll do it. If you want to. I would recommend that you amend ORS 162.415 or write a specific statute that says the legislature shall not, or whatever it is, and let's go right to the heart of it and nail it down. And I'll support any bill that or any amendment goes to that. I'm with you.
Well, okay, would you like to go on now, Grant? Okay, in we did not address Section 7 or 8 last week, instead jumped to 9, which would, as written now, be have to be reworked to pick up the people we've defined above, to include 3 or 4 classes of people: legislators, statewide elected officials, the judicial, and the administrative. They have 4 different classes. And the question is whether you have the same response from each 4 classes or more than one response to differentiate between the different classes. The legislator must give a written notice in the same manner as an administrator would do, or whether he could have a different standard for announcing a conflict.
that he'd have to disqualify himself, if in fact he had a conflict of interest. No abstention, no
sitting and going on to vote, if he had a conflict of interest, he'd have to disqualify himself. And then thirdly, the administrative employee, the consultant to the legislative committee, the staff worker to the PUC, would disclose, and then, if necessary, take himself off the case or off the matter. Trying to divide it into three categories, because there are three, at least three, two alternatives, but that's recognizing the difference between the legislative and the executive and the judiciary. And all three have their conflicts, come to them in a different manner, and in my view, all three must be solved by three different techniques.
Well, what does the law say offhand about judges who have a conflict when they remove themselves from the case?
I don't know. I'm trying to see. What's the time?
What does
the judicial canon of ethics says that you can't render a decision on a matter of which you have a conflict of interest? But I don't know. Is there a state law? I don't know either.
If there was, could we refer to that, which would take care of it, where it says.
Well, they won't answer this one.
Why?
Yeah. How about the conflict of interest? I think it's important that we keep those two aspects. They're both in this bill, but I think it's important to keep them. I don't mean two different bills, I mean in Earl's stuff, but I think it's important to keep in mind that there's disclosure where you say what you've got, and then let the public decide whether it's a conflict or not. And the recognition on the part of the individual where he says, wow, I've got a conflict. And we're going heavy at the present time on disclosure, going light on the conflict. And if we took out Section 9, which is part of my recommendation, we'd be going very light on the disclosure of conflict, or the statement of conflict. An alternative would be to kind of pick up what Don Lerner's talking about, and that is to have a three-form type, depending on what branch of government you're in, on a declaration of conflict. Sorry, you're three.
Well, we need to really write then three sections to this one. For Section 9, I think so too. Let's go ahead and we can work on that. We'll get a hold of the Legislative Council and see if they can do what we're talking about.
In effect, for the legislator, then, what he would do would be, and I think we can borrow from Section 3 here, is that we define what a conflict of interest is. And I think, frankly, the conflict of interest that Don used means the conflict of a substantial, private, pecuniary interest of a member, or as we say, of a public official.
Mm-hmm.
Is far superior to the effect directly or indirectly its financial interest. So I would recommend that we use Don Lerner's language, the conflict of interest, and then build into the fact that we have a legislative responsibility or way of handling it. And we might as well try to see if we can abstain if we, I objected that, but maybe that's the way to do it. We'll allow it.
Allow them at least to abstain if they want. If they can try.
In effect, we're adopting Section 3 of Senate Bill 63 of last session for the legislative response, and then we must come up with a judicial response. Mm-hmm. And we might look to one Lance was talking about to see the federal what they require them to do. And the language, frankly, in the bill already on lines 6 through 12 of page 4, I think it's pretty good for the administrator, where the executive side. So if we take Section 3 from 63, the legislative side, we need the judiciary one, and maybe state law, but Tom and Steve and I share the inability to tell you what it is the first time. I think it's in the canon of ethics.
I
should.
Right.
Yeah. And then here's Senator Staley. He can tell us. Ed, is there any statute relating to your knowledge to judicial conflict of interest and what they must do, step down? Is it not in canon of ethics as opposed to a statute? Or you're going to look at the statute and answer, aren't you?
I don't think it's in the statute, but I was going to look. It could be chapter 1 or chapter 2 or chapter 3, and I'll take very long.
Well, if we can
find it. 9 talks about attorney's duties.
I think if it's in the statute, fine. If it's not, we must either the Supreme Court rule or perhaps the canon of ethics and put them in the law. Mm-hmm. And we have those three, and then the one for the executive branch is pretty much an adaptation of Section 4, and that is if you still assign the matter to another employee who does not have a conflict of interest.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's worked well.
Okay, in Section 11, that was retained last week.
Mr. Chairman, in that regard, I think with the other than a contract of employment for personal services helped that we were in a period of disaster when one time this went down to school districts and so on, but now that it's back up to the state level and with that contract of employment for personal services, I think we, I hate to keep bringing up the house, but this would have substantial, this is, I would think that it's very close to the area that they've been discussing a rule change in the House of Representatives, frankly. Other than a contract for employment personal services eliminates the real concern, I think what they're getting at here, and why don't you come and jump at me at the contrary, and that is somebody selling, who's in the gravel business and is also, is part-time, is also assistant state engineer selling gravel to the state of Oregon. I think it's fine with the amendment other than a contract.
Mm-hmm. And section 12, Senator Carson, is on the agenda. Take that out.
I imagine my recommendation is we take it out because I think it's very Covered similar to section 4, which is also repealing the text.
In section 13, we were left as it stands with a couple of minor amendments. We took out in section, subsection 4, the first line of provision of the law notwithstanding. The remainder of it was left, and it speaks to the Ethics Commission and how that commission is going to report back to the body, etc. I'm not sure how that would fit in with in relation to an ethics division of the Secretary of State. Part of it can be reworked.
Yep. Mr. Chairman, I think the issue there is I originally took out all of Section 4 because I thought it would be an administrative nightmare. If the candidate didn't file a statement of economic interest, how to get him off the ballot. When you were talking about school districts and service districts and all the variety of things, so I took it out. Now that we've redefined it really on the state level, I think we can, in fact, put the burden on the Ethics Division or Fair Practices Commission or whatever to have this. So I think, as Grant has indicated, I think we can restore.
This we could tie in very well with just saying that his statement of economic interest must be filed with his.
Well, they're all going to be with the Secretary of State.
I know, but with his CNE, because, you know, if you don't file your CNE within 30 days, your name doesn't appear.
Well,
you could just file it right to it.
Except, aren't we requiring, this is one of the first things you have to do. Let's jump down to 15. Section 15, Grant has better language, but in effect, all public officials, as of the effective date of this act, shall file a statement. And then everybody that comes online, within, in the effective date is 1 January 74. Everybody that comes online within 60 days, and what I was thinking about is 60 days after you file your declaration, you have to have your statement of economic interest, which is what the president has. If you want to put it with a CME, it works out about the same thing.
Yeah, but I'm just thinking about making reports come at the same time, all part of it.
Okay. Except we want to get the incumbent as of 1 January 74, I think that's...
Yeah.
Okay, section 14, that would probably, it might be in fact better to look at the amended draft of May 7, beginning in section... Section 11. Now, this is the language doesn't exactly correspond, but it may come with either one of that would probably be all right. The section 14 is straightforward, but it may, as we add on new people, we'll have to add on new parts of it, as far as the DAs and the judges, etc. You would probably get them under A, but then you've got. Okay, he was appointed to his office by an elected public official.
You can catch him again.
Okay, you've got your point. If he's an employee of any public regulatory agency, well, you've got to, that would have to be reworked to include your state agency heads and et cetera, or maybe use some of this language over in Section 11, including the Section 11, Subsection 1, each agency director or state agency mm-hmm. head or whatever is required to file, shall file, et cetera. One or the other, which would be all right.
Mr. Chairman, we're trying, really, now we're getting back to redefining public officials. I don't know, isn't that where we're at? So I think that rather than fighting over Section 14, we ought to really return to the definition of what a public official is, and that's really where Grant was. of the definition that we worked out Friday noon. The three that are obvious is a person who's elected to an office by a vote of the people, and we wanted to extend that to, limit that really to Congress, the U.S. Senate, U.S. Representative, statewide office, legislature, judicial, which include the Supreme Court, Court of Appeals, Circuit Court, and District Court, and attorneys. So that's really what we mean by being elected to office by a vote of the people. So elected to any one of the following offices, and I think we ought to limit them, just lay them right out. In this particular area, we really can't leave anything to guess. Now, the next one is appointed to office by an elected official. The alternative might be to, this is kind of interesting, I think we might try to say appointed to any office which requires a confirmation of the Senate. And what I'm doing is playing on our egos, because we're fizzling about changing almost every office the governor appoints to requiring confirmation by the Senate. Point being is that we succeed in our one goal, and that is to have advice from the Senate, to the Senate, who will then pick up almost every appointed office by an elected official. Now that won't perhaps pick up the governor's commission on youth. I don't know that we ought to pick up the governor's commission on youth. Maybe we should. I have no fixed notion on it. That would be one of
them. Well, it's appointed by the appointed for that.
Well, it's appointed office by an elected official. We can just leave it that way.
Yeah. And that covers the ones that claim honest points.
Oh, clearly. Oh, yeah.
The appoints part of those, the governor appoints part of those, and the House of Senate.
All right. Well, then let's just leave it that way. And then finally is an employee of any public regulatory agency. And Grant has tried to find out what a public regulatory agency is. You can't find it.
I think that we
better set it out right away. And I think we ought to ask for people to send in their nominations. I mean, the people around here to send in their nominations of what they deem to be public regulatory agencies. And we'll list them by statutory name and number. Other than that, we're just going to build in a Supreme Court case. I'd rather.
How are we going to? And that's what I'm wondering about too. Some way we have to. If we do start looking at it, we're going to have to. There's something about no conflict of interest if you're an optometrist on the optometry board.
Well, no, we don't do that. If we say is an employee of any public regulatory agency as defined in Section 2 hereof, and in Section 2 we say a public for the purpose of this statute or section or this act. Public regulatory agency is any one of the following. PUC,
we'll have to listen so that you won't have some of the down.
Well, I think if we leave public regulatory agency up to grab, it could be extended very broad. Senator Bailey, I'm going to pass that around so others can go.
Well, I'm thinking about the conflict. If we get that far into conflict, how is anybody from the bar not going to be in conflict?
My view is that we wouldn't list them as a public regulatory.
Well, that's what I said, and you have to list
them. Yeah, well, let's lay them out, and then we can handle about whether
there's 170 boards or something like that.
Well, now wait a minute. We've already picked up the board. And I don't call it, in other words, those are appointed.
They're regulatory boards. You have the optometrist, the embalmers, everything you can think of. And those are made up of people from that business, so they've got to be exempt. And not have a conflict of interest because they're regulating their own.
What Senator Bailey, for the purpose of the record, Mr. Chairman, passing around is a news release that's going out all over the wire services. Clip from an AP source. Came into election committee today. The only guy in a light suit with no tie. I hope for that.
Just to give you an idea of the kinds of. Appointive offices there are in putting together, I think it's SB 262, the one that would 242 draw in
some of them.
There are, I went to Legislative Council and asked them for the total number that they had looked over in helping to write that bill, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4 pages of gubernatorial appointments not subject to Senate confirmation right now, not. Counting the Senate bill.
All you got to do is take out a blue book and it starts listing.
Yeah, and then you have
nearly 200 of them.
One page of gubernatorial appointments confirmed by Senate, and it's subject to gubernatorial approval, not subject to Senate confirmation, and then the final permutation, not subject to gubernatorial approval or Senate confirmation, one whole page. So we've got a couple of hundred to choose from.
But to
show the sort of thing I'm talking about. The State Board of Barber Examiners, the State Board of Plumber Examiners, the State Textbook Commission. All of these kinds of things are going to be involved right in that. You're going to have real conflicts, and they just can't, you know, you wouldn't want laymen on that.
Oh, Mr. Chairman.
Because it would just destroy the whole purpose of the board.
As a member of a laymen company, we propose a bill that one layman to every bureau in Congress. If I think you want someone laymen, you can have it. But if we don't want a plumber's board made up of all laymen.
It might be easier to just get copies of that for each member of the committee and just take, go yes, no on whichever one. Well, what good would a layman do on the medical examiners?
No,
you're going to give the examination for doctors.
My input.
But what input are they going to put in there? That's what I'm getting at. Or a member of the bar exam. What good would a layman do there in examining people? Well, I'm just telling you.
All right, Mr. Chairman, I think what we're talking about here is I think a lawyer who sits on the board of governors of the Oregon State Bar has obvious conflict with the public understanding. He's a member of the bar. I don't think there's anything punitive in the bill that, in effect, requires him to stand down. And if we use the definition of conflict that Senator Wilner provided, which is a substantial private pecuniary interest, by golly, a board of bar governors ought to stand down on decisions of the board of governors when he's got a substantial private pecuniary interest in place. And I really don't think, as long as we don't prohibit them from being on the board of governors and require the optometrist to be on the board of governors for the bar and the lawyers to be on the medical examiner and switch around the staff, I don't see anything wrong with requiring the board of governors to declare by make their disposal. And to...
one thing, what I'm trying to say is that everything that you make on the bar is going to have some kind of interest to a lawyer.
Well, my point is... Well, I'm not sure. I see your point, but I think that's where we get into conflict of interest. The assumption every bill that comes out of the judiciary committee is somehow better than the rest of every lawyer is one that's commonly held in the legislature. But in fact, it's not quite accurate.
Not
quite accurate.
Not every bill.
As I told you,
no bill, not all of them.
Many times, I hope. Well, Mr. Chairman, as I told you several times, I hope I live long enough to have the education committee made of nothing but educators, so that every one of your bills is killed on the floor because you're the conflict of interest. So I really think that. I don't see any harm in requiring members of the Board of Governors. As a matter of fact, it was the bar of the Senate in declarations of conflict of interest. And I think the bar is a good example. It's probably our strongest union in the state of Oregon. And I think that it's incumbent upon the bar to lead and not to follow in this area. And I would very much hope that the bar would be quick to qualify and to satisfy the requirements if, in fact, it does constitute a regulatory state agency. Not appointed by the governor, so the only place you would come in is whether it's a regulatory public agency.
Mr. Chairman, it might be useful to take the John Wilner's definition of substantial private pecuniary interest and put into Section 2 in definition, a definition directly of conflict of interest.
What's that?
Doing that and then reinforcing it with some of the language that the Attorney General brought to us earlier, to reinforce that, enlarge that definition, saying conflict of interest is, and then do that, and then following, just to take out the businesses of saying you can do what you have to do when you have a conflict of interest, that is, as an administrator, as a judicial officer, as a legislator, but not just refer to it as a conflict of interest. Some of the language I'm thinking of would be in his Section 3, an interest or membership, it would be not be a conflict of interest if an interest or membership in a particular business, industry, occupation, or other class is required by law as a prerequisite for the holding by the person of the office. Then go on, say that proposed or required regulation, measure, decision, or other action would affect all other like businesses, which would get your optometrists and all the rest of them dealing with their own class, or members of the industry, which would get your plumbers, occupation, or class in the same degree. And then
the other thing would be
reinforce your definition.
I think I'm misspeaking myself when I say that the Board of Bar Governors. Board of Governors or State Bar was included. Under the common cause definition of a public official, they would not be, because they're not elected to office by voting people, they're not appointed to the office by elected officials, and they're not an employee of a public regulatory agency. So I think that if we stick with the common cause definition, we would not stick up. Now, question is whether we should or shouldn't. I have no objection to picking
up. Aren't they chosen by statute, though, how they're chosen?
Yeah, but
we just passed one, so
sure.
you'd be an elected official by statute. You're not elected by your own group.
Well, I don't think you could say he's elected on by a vote of the people. Not
that I understand.
The only people that vote are those
who vote
during State Farm, pay dues to the
plan. But I'm thinking about where you're set by statute rather than by a constitution of your own.
Well,
I think every time we turn around, there's something that we're passing about the Bar Association. I never could quite understand why all of the Bar Association was by statute, not by...
I don't think we trust them in the bylaws.
In the bylaws, yeah.
We've had a number of attempts made by the Bar to get it out of the statute, and it's been in and out.
I always feel rather strange about voting on Bar rules and regulations, because I know nothing about it, and I've always felt rather strange.
I think
it's coming here for us to be voting on.
Earl's reminded me they didn't defeat one this year. I think it's been historical that every 2 years the Oregon State Bar comes in with a reorganization proposal to essentially remove all the statutory language and put it into the Bar Board of Governors. And uniformly, the legislature, which is a minority of lawyers, have generally decided to kill the bill. Most of them killed the victory, I'm going to add, though, which is
a little irony.
Yeah, right.
But,
well,
we were talking about the former board. There was some criticism that was voiced at that point that because of various practices and so on, there is a limitation for the requirement going to field with him to the crisis. There's a short supply of plumbers in the field. Now, on section 3, page 3 of the bill, no public official, I just go in, no
yes.
Public, okay, no public official can use an official position or office to obtain financial gain for himself or any member of his household and so on, for any business with which he is a member of his household, remember it. Now, in view of that, in view of a criticism that has come, say, the plumbing board, I'm sure there are other fields that are involved in similar situations, would this apply?
Well, that comes back to the definition. What's a substantial gain?
Or would it apply like in the case of say, the beauty board, whatever it's called, board of cosmetology? That's a testing situation. And of course, in many of these boards where tests are involved, there's always a charge, the barbary board or whatever, the test is too difficult. In the old days, you see the barbers out of the field. So, supply is.
Well, that's what we were asking about all of these, because
yeah.
The same thing would come up in the architect or embalmers or any one of these that's a licensing board.
Chairman, as much as I'd like to solve that problem, I really don't think we can solve it, because even if we said, for instance, that it does apply, it's a matter of proof that a member voted no on allowing 15 apprentices instead of 10 was based using a certain financial position to obtain financial gains for himself is extremely difficult to prove, in my judgment. I really think, frankly, that the way we ought to go is either if grant is indicated comes from the Attorney General, or by sticking with common cause language and talking about an employee of a public regulatory agency, and then defining public regulatory agencies as those that are really state agencies. And for the time being, at least, leaving the Board of Optometry and the Board of Bar Examiners and the Board of whatever it is, out of them.
Just pick the major one.
Well, I think what the thrust of the bill is getting is the PUC and the OLCC and those that hold licensing power or permit power over the people of Oregon, as opposed to holding over a particular profession. Now, I don't mean to sweep it under the rug. I think there's some evil that ought to be sought at in some of those, whether it be plumbers or bar or optometrists or whatever, but Norma Paul sent me a photocopy of a, Maryland editorial appeared in the Wall Street Journal or the National Observer, which talks about festooning a bill with all sorts of, it's called jokes, and festoon a bill with all sorts of amendments, assuring yourself because of the amendments it'll fail. Well, in Maryland it passed both houses with substantial majority, and I guess they've got a nightmare that's become a delight. I really think that I'd rather start with a small, firm step rather than a weak, large step in this area. And I think that if we pick up public regulatory agency and pick up PUC and OLCC and those that hassle the public, or deal with the public to be more appropriate, or hassle the case may be, would be the ones that this would be our best step. And leave for another day the question I'm going to answer them.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, there's another thing too. I would hate to pass a bill that considers that commerce board, plumbers and board of cosmetology and all that would put these people in a position of looking like they have substantial conflicts of interest in their position.
Therefore, Mr. Chairman, I would think that if Granton would really conform very closely to the common cause, he would pick it up, because in fact the bombers are appointed by Ludeman, I think. And he is in turn appointed by the governor, so you have that check, but he's not in fact appointed. The bombers board is not in fact one of these categories. And one of the first steps for the division would be to list all those that are, and maybe we can help them by listing all those that are covered by this.
So that we would take under Section 14C.
Well, no, it actually comes under Section 2.8, public official means, and we have the expanded definition of one of the elected, but we know what we're talking about. Congress kind of knows that Larry Wilson is elected.
And we just have to go right ahead and list those boards.
Well, I'd say 1A, U.S. Senator, 1B would be U.S. Congressman, 1. See, I'd list them. I'd still make a longer stand, but by golly, there'd be less to say about
liquor control, commission, rating, commission.
Well, no, I'm not into those. I'm talking about elected office by other people. So I'd have the 5 or 6 categories that we listed.
Right, yeah, we got those. We do have those.
All right. Then 2 is appointed to office by an elected official. And
you wouldn't have to define that.
It seemed to me that maybe the thing to do would be appointed to office by governor, secretary, by any one of those mentioned in 1A through Z above.
But I'll bet you if you go through these, like the Beef Commission and the Hop Commission and these, you'll find the governor appoints them.
Well, we're talking about them. Okay, so what we're saying is that they're going to be required to make a decision. Or 3 is an employee of a public regulatory agency, and then under Section 2.9, public regulatory agency means the Public Utilities Commission, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the Oregon Racing Commission.
I just got such a kick out of looking at some of these. The Hop Commission, the Prune and Plum Growers.
Well, now you're in some of the major areas.
Chairman,
the Strawberry and the Bartlett
Pear. Public regulatory
agency. Yep. The reason is that the 3 chairmen or the 3 members of the OLCC are appointed by the governor. Therefore, they're picked up in the category above.
This particular list, Wally, is
let me go on. If an employee of any public regulatory agency can have an economic interest in the activity regulated by the agency by whom it's employed. So it's not every employee, it's those where there's a conflict that has to follow. So if somebody from OLCC has stock in Kenley, they've got it close, and I think they are.
Right, but then how far down you're going to take in all of these things?
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to list them.
No, but I'm wondering what you're going to do when you get down. You're going to put that clause in that Granton has then if...
No, if
how are you going to avoid conflict then if we use conflict? Because everybody there is going to have a conflict.
Well,
under our original definition.
Under the substantial?
If you're a pear grower on this pear growing board, this is some that he appoints. I started to go down all those agriculture ones. Fire commission, Bartlett pear, strawberry, prune and plum, hop, rye grass, orchard grass, potato. That's just those, and every one of those people is almost going to have to be a potato grower to be on the potato commission. And they set up marketing.
Yep.
Some of those set up marketing. Yep. Would you have a real interest in?
The question I'd ask, though, and I guess it's a real.
Would you have a real interest in one of those marketing groups?
I would hope so.
Yeah, but the question really comes in. It means the conflict of a substantial private pecuniary interest of a member of the. Okay, the question I'd ask, if a seller were.
I guess it went out.
if the fellow were on the prune commission and he were making a decision and he had a substantial private pecuniary interest.
Every one of them are going to have them. If you're the Redmond the potato growers, the biggest potato growers in the state are going to be on this because they're setting a marketing, which means the price.
You're proving your point because I'm not making my point.
Oh, okay.
No, my point is that if his interest is not different from every other potato grower in the state of Oregon, then in fact he has no conflict of interest.
We
don't think he's discussing his potatoes.
Yeah, we have to adopt that one.
Okay, let's go. But your point is well taken. If I have to explain it, I'm not making my point. If I'm not making my point, then it's going to be misread and fancy. We've got trouble for us, so we can begin with it.
I'm not. It would be on section 2, would be a 9 regulatory agency, and that would be 8 public official,
yeah.
Would be appointed by.
I was probably in the definition.
We'd have to
probably
add that. That would be your new
4. 2-6 after commission. Or no, it'd be division, so it moves up. It'd be probably a new 5.
New 5.
Conflict of interest.
Okay. I think we've got a general understanding of this now. Why don't we leave that one and let him go ahead and draw that up, and we'll be coming back to it. But I think we're all in pretty much accord on this. That type of board ought to still be that type of board.
Okay, I agree. Let's leave them out.
All right, let's take section 16. And what did you have on this before you're going to start to get now?
Section 15 is basically what it is. Section 16, my recommendation, Chairman, is that we, rather than go to specific dollar amount, go to the disclosure category. And it's very similar to your draft.
Mm-hmm.
I think that a statement of economic interest will be filed on a form described by the Fair Practices Commission or Division or whatever it is. And all public officials, as we defined earlier, will file it on or before January 1974, or when they declare the candidacy, or when they've been in fact nominated for one of the positions. A would be the language you see right in front of you, the identity by name of all officers, directorships, or fiduciary relationships held by him or a member of his household, and I would add during the preceding year, simply because that seems to be the language that's carried throughout. There is a little redundancy between that and, as Grant pointed out earlier, the definition of a business or a business with which it's associated. But what I'm trying to get at here is primarily, for lack of a better word, the do-gooding agencies with which you're associated, or the paternal, societal, whatever, which really are not a business in that sense. And I think it's important to most of us put in our campaign material anyway. Interest we have. Then the legal description of all real property which he or a member of his household has or has had during the preceding year, any interest in which, it should say.
And you might pick up the language with the exception of the residence. Where is that in there?
Yeah,
well, it's on the last line, except in real estate.
Okay, except the real estate used by the first file. What we anticipate here is that the commission would allow them to use a photocopy of their deed as a compliance of their various, so they wouldn't have to have a long form. They submit a photocopy of all their deeds. So that's not in your need not be. I was trying to get a short-handed way of doing it, but somebody answered Bill and somebody commented that I think it's important that we know. I was going to go township, range, or whatever. I don't want a meets and bounds description of some of these properties that will have a voluminous area. But if they can just photocopy their own deed, that's not much of an effort. So I'm not worried about that. And I think the point was made that it may become important to find out where in Township 8 West Willamette Meridian the person owns the property. I would add, I would move what's now E up to C, and that is the source by name, that is a strike and category of the amount of any income, and I strike including capital gains, whether or not taxable received by him or a member of his household during the preceding year. You declare by source, Carson partnership. Not the amount, but the source. Oregon Education Association, honorarium, or whatever it may be, and let it go at that. Then I'd add a D would be what is now the old C, name of each creditor to whom he or a member of his household owes or has owed in the preceding year money in excess of $2,000 and the interest rate. Strike the balance of it. There is some objection to that. Some businessmen, I'm told, would not like to disclose how much they're in debt. It would not be a good, some are have a lot of, the argument goes, they have a lot of assets on one side, and we're not asking them to disclose the assets. They have a lot of liabilities on the other side, so they may appear to be terribly insolvent, when in fact they are not. So I'm not really hung up on that, and if any one of these had to go, I think the creditor argument would be the first that I'd eliminate. Because what you're really saying is, if the guy owes, if he's a businessman, he very well may have $30,000, $40,000 of debt owed. Let's say the guy's a sole proprietorship in an automobile.
Or
a farmer, yeah. And he may have a bundle outstanding, and what we're doing is subtly requiring him to disclose his assets just to offset his liability. And I think most of us have agreed that we don't want him to acquire the dollar amount. So, G is a soft figure. I would have put it in, but I think that I'm persuaded to leave out the creditor.
Well, why not list the creditor without the amount, as long as it's over $2,000?
Well, okay, that's the way it reads. You don't list the amount. There's no amount listed in any of this, but if you had a string of creditors.
Why, I see the guy. Yeah, we do that. Right?
If you have 15 creditors, you'd know that each one of them is worth $2,000
better. Yeah, mm-hmm, I see.
And I might have problem.
I'd
go either way on that line.
I don't either. I know what you mean.
Then a new E is kind of a combination of F, but the name of each business with which he or a member of his household has been associated. And that's what I mean is each business is defined in Section 2 of the Act during the preceding year. If any such business with which he is a member, he or a member of his household is associated as business with or is regulated by any agency, as we defined earlier, he shall specify the nature of such business or regulation. And then F is one my preference would be to leave it out. And I share my obvious conflict of interest being a lawyer. I've never fully understood, I think I know, but I've never fully understood why lawyers must list their business, and physicians don't have to list their patients, ad companies don't have to list their clients, and real estate people don't have to list their clients. All of a sudden, just lawyers, and lawyers are not the most populous. For instance, we ought to go for educators to list their students or other things because there are more of them than there are lawyers and more insurance people. So it seems to me, or if there were at one time, that my first recommendation would be to delete any requirements the lawyer lists his clients. Now, I have no objection, personally, and I think it might be some value to leave in F if the individual filing an attorney lists a list of all matters in which any public official or agency is a party in which he or a member of his firm with which he is associated represents a client for a fee, saying the name of his client. My preference would be to forbid lawyers from taking a case if they've already wanted to serve the legislature. That's the way to get at it, and that would be my preference. But if we don't want to
Chairman, Wally, is there a time where someone might hire an attorney and simply not like my client to, but I would not want anyone to know that you were
with
me?
Well, as a matter of fact, we have an ethical ethical opinion from the American Bar Association indicates, although Senator Fraley disagrees with this, at least Mr. Harms and I agree, and perhaps Steve Tomlin would comment on it. But I think absolutely forbids me to disclose the name of the client. It becomes unethical.
Well,
besides
that, is there a case that you can think of where I might hire you and I would not want anybody to know that I
have
hired you?
Well, quite obviously, when I call up the district attorney's office and ask what he would do in a given situation, there are any number of cases where the person that I represent, the fact that I represent him is extremely important. Let me give you a quick example. Purchasing property, or frequently you'll have a call in a law office to call up and say, do you represent Mr. Brown? Well, the one who's calling is Mrs. Brown, and she thinks Mr. Brown's gone to the lawyer to see about getting a divorce. And if you haven't included your secretary again, oh, yes, yes, we represent Mr. Brown in the domestic relations matter. He's in here yesterday, we're fine. and it might be the practice of law is not kept with its full disclosure that everybody else is talking about, but it's a very sensitive area, and I agree with that, disagree with Senator Staley. I would argue that go ahead and leave F, but not disclose the fine. I have a second line to fall back on, if that's not agreeable, and say anybody over $2,000. But my preference would be, and I'm certainly willing to change my mind if somebody can give me a good reason.
What about if you took it on a different tack? Only those that you have on retainer, or corporations or something like this, which would be in a different category altogether, wouldn't it? If well, we're, say, I happen to know of a case a number of years ago where a man from my area was on container warehouses from Georgia Pacific, from all of those, and very active in politics, but I would say this is super tough, but you make quite a fortune out of it.
I would agree that if you're talking about being on retainer, particularly
which is
while
a different
we're
proposition
related to what Earl was talking about, I would agree. The only problem with closing the retainer gap is that all of a sudden you go on a monthly billing trip. Retainer is generally
not popular.
Yeah, it's a dying
practice.
Yeah, because
so there's so many in-house lawyers for a number of years.
Another thing, this is written now. What if you and we did have
along
the
line
here.
So,
what if you were a private detective?
I think it'd be true if it wasn't better. Before we took it out on section two, required in any business which a client is a client of the person, and business includes the person in his individual self employed capacity. It'd be kind of, a limp detective, I guess you'd say. Mr. Chairman, I would invite Blanche or Bill or somebody to work on that. I realize and I declare my conflict. I am a lawyer. But I really, if we say and ask if the individual filing is an attorney, a list of all matters in which any public official or agency is a party, in which he or any member of the law firm with which he is associated represented a client for a fee, saying the name of each client. Now, the reason I say that is that's a public record.
You don't object.
No, I have no objection to that. All you're doing there.
You want to strike me?
Yeah.
I think
you can do that. Listing of a particular client.
First of all, it's not something that's individual. It was $8 million.
Yeah, limit that. Take that out.
Well, we would do the
public official. That's the part that's public record.
Right.
The other part is supposed to be private.
You don't have any conflict with the ABA by disclosing the list of your clients over $2,000? Well,
why would you pick on
how about all advertising agencies listing all their clients over $2,000? Or all doctors listing surgeries over $500?
But an advertising agency would.
How about a used car sales and all sales over $1,500?
The Cadillac sales. There's a lot of
money. Well, why? Why use Zinger Lawyers? Why, not you, but why? Where? Don't you have to do a PR group? Tell me about the difference between a PR group.
I think PR groups have as their interest the matter of making things public. The lawyers are not necessarily in that line of business.
You think packaging is making something public?
Well, there have been a few regulations about that, but I think the public, that's my only basis, is that the public has a belief that there is a higher percentage of lawyers connected with the government, and that they work their wonders in serious ways, and therefore maybe we ought to know a little bit more about other professions.
Of course, the interesting thing is, that's my point, though, Eric, the interesting thing is most people believe that 95% of legislators are lawyers. The facts are quite the contrary. There's 7.5 and 9 in the Senate, which is probably the lowest of any state in the union by the basis of what I've been able to tell, are in fact lawyers. And yet we're still operating under the idea that 95% of them are lawyers.
Well, I think what he's saying, though, Wally, is that percentage-wise, now lawyers, what are there, 2,500 in the state?
3,600.
That your percentage is much greater.
Than PR? Oh, I doubt that. Ooh, I doubt that. We got more PR people in the House of Representatives by my account than we have dirt money. So don't. People that are in public
relations? I didn't know we had.
Oh, I knew that
we got in public relations.
Well, Mike Raytheon, Les Hawthorne, what's the University of Pacific? Independent operator?
I thought he was personnel or something.
No. That's my point, is that when this was directed was at a time that a large number of the lawyers were one on retainer and two were the major dominating fact in the legislature.
Could you just write a general statute to take in whatever services that over a specified amount that include public relations and lawyers, but also that making sure would be
I don't think it's unusual for lawyers to be in the legislative business because they deal in law constantly. Probably have a greater assistance.
But certainly, I'm sure Roger would mind taking up electrical contracting business. He's involved in legislation that deals with rural cooperatives and all that sort of thing. Maybe it's been needed. You can build in a limit here. That we include the smaller cooperatives.
Yes.
Earl, it seems to me that if we start getting down to the good in this case, we've got people in higher ed who are going to be voting with salaries. We've got public teachers who before long probably are going to be setting salaries for public schools. We've got farmers who are voting on farm issues all over the place. We've got insurance people who are working on insurance. There's all kinds of things that we start listing.
See, those who seem to be, everybody knows who wants to look in the blue book, like as I work for Fort State University. That's known. And I identify. And if I start having curious behavior, I start my voting record very bright.
You're assuming everybody
knows. Well, but I mean, it's a matter of public record. You see, it's in the voter pamphlet, it's in the blue book, that's known. Someone who's a farmer. But because those issues are identified, and I think it's a different category when you're talking about what clients might or said might be represented in public relations.
Oh, yeah, wait a minute.
Well, that's in this respect. I remember waiting meetings. I teach in higher education. I'm not what if I was going down the waiting meetings, lifting arms and saying the instructors and I come in with a proposal that is if I went around to Senator Ripper and to Representative Ingalls and all my old friends are waiting for me and said, hey, look, fellas, you know, let's help me out here. And twisted their arms a little bit and got them to go along with me. This is something that wouldn't be indicated in the blue book.
Well, let me take a step further. The lawyers sell the service. Okay. Let's put everybody to sell the service. Okay. You know, if that's the evil. Okay. Now, those who are on wages, either from part of state number two, whatever, that's right there. It's in the blue book. That's all you do. But if you sell your services, as in any of the service trades, or professions, declare over $2,000, that's a used car service, unless he's on wages, but most of my respect on commission. If it's important to know where the lawyer does his business, I say the farmer. For instance, does the farmer sell directly to Birdseye? How do you vote on the cooperative? Does he sell the cooperative? If it's that important to understand where the guy gets his services, let's ask all people.
I agree.
Isn't that already in the bill and endorsed by name and category and group?
Well,
by him and a member of the household, we can just put the professions on the same footing as a businessman or
just put one profession.
Yeah, but if we then adopted Senator Carson's proposal, or if you adopted the Senator Carson's proposal,
no, I think you're right the first time.
That, all people who self serve, or you could limit it to professions and this was a profession. I don't know whether you want to know what a doctor's plan was in
that's a gallbladder.
I think what really is what the question is, and what I'm trying to find out, is if by being employed in the country today, as opposed to the website and so forth, what, if any, private business is that bring? That's the thing I think. Not whether the lawyer has a income from the tax of all lawyers in the public relations. But this is the 10 house good.
How would you figure that out? Would you compare it to, let's take Halleck's concern. The only concerns he's going to deal with are going to be corporations. Because you and I aren't going to go carry on a campaign to sell beauty rest soap or something like that because we don't make that. So every client he has would have to be a corporation. Now which one would you pick out?
Of course,
sometime or another, every one of them is going to have some kind of a bill.
Steve made a point though that and I don't know how, Ted, whether he's a business or a sole proprietorship, it was a sole proprietorship, then the new C, which is the old E, picked him up because it starts by name of an income. So if he had PPE with an income, the problem was coming, I think that's your point, that if he were in a law firm or a PR firm, the PPE account would go to the Regency Advertising Company, and he would show Regency Advertising Company as one of his sources of income, and it would wash the PPE account through it. And that was your concern?
Well, whatever the avenue might be, it would be going because
the position. He's saying, did you get the money because of your position?
Well, of course, that's
pretty hard.
The head of the individual and saying, you know, did you get the contract speech or did you get the speech engagement or any sort of income because you're.
Well, that's what he was saying. And I said, how can you tell
it?
Fine,
we'll do.
Did you get promoted because you were a legislator? You wouldn't say, how could you?
What I'm doing is thinking out the categories. The original attempt, or one suggestion, was to split the psych amount. The next step was to do it by category, which I think is an improvement. I frankly think that what we're after is not the involvement. I won't watch and everybody's heard my speech on that. I think that the question of closing potential areas of conflict in 100 shares of warehouse or to me might be a heck of a lot more conflict than 250,000 shares of warehouse or to Sam Johnson. And I think the closure of the various categories of potential conflict is more important than speaking over the shoulder of the legislator or any of the public officials and figuring out what his last month's check balance was. I think the public would be served, at least initially, if it doesn't work, we correct it in years to the future. And that is the declaration of categories, and that's the major change in 16. The rest of it is just a question of, well, really the only conflict that I know of is the one on lawyers. The rest of it, I think I've included for the most part precisely what the common cause does.
Okay. I like that Wally touched on Cindy there, and it just occurred to me, for instance, it could be very misleading if you want to list liability only. I know of a legislator who has a substantial mortgage on his house with a savings and loan. He was invited to be a member of the board, and one of the reasons was because if he was a consumer, a user, the only one who had a substantial mortgage. Well, that would be very misleading to list that, even though that was the primary reason for serving on the board of an SNL, why there are so many things involving the fact that he had a mortgage with him. I don't think it would seem like, unless we're going to list the other offsetting assets, it would be very misleading.
At one point, we had exempted
the home mortgage.
Didn't
the home mortgage.
That was in the draft bill that
for the very reasons
that
you were talking about.
Would exempt the resident. We can put that in.
Mr. Chairman, I want to really go back
to you.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to bring your brain.
We're going to get this all printed up into a new form, and then you can go through
on Wednesday. Okay, then I'd put back in there in that. That will be the new D, except for the resident. And if I'm not mistaken, you struck the dollar amount, or did we not?
No.
You struck the dollar amount and the interest rate.
No, we left the 2,000.
We left
the 2,000
in there, which is the reason I've done that is I've had my big speech in category.
Otherwise, you'd have everything.
The problem is that you'd have to put down a local grocery store and, and mobile oil and be in every week.
Right. And the interest rate.
Well, somebody thought that was important, and the BD Robizo, the Robozo home that Peter Eisenhower was in, everybody wants to know what rent they're paying and what the interest rate is. I think it'd be interesting if somebody had an $80,000 mortgage and was paying 3%.
I'd like to know why.
I'd like to know why. Yeah. So, I don't know. The interest rate, don't
have it. But I think 2,000 gets it above the local, you know, your own.
Subsection 2 of 16 you've struck, in other words.
Yeah,
okay. Does that fit all right with you, Tom, then exempting the residents?
And 3 left, subsection 3 you left in?
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Section 17 I left as is. It's been amended to require the final updating statement.
Mm-hmm.
Wait a minute, I have no later to join this. Yeah. Okay, you've got a 31 days.
Boy, I'm glad to see that one part struck out there.
Yeah.
By the State Central Committee. in the bill that was put up for Senator Ripper, we had them staggered so that your elected people came in January to take benefit, or in the earlier part of the year to take benefit.
The legislature, yeah.
Put it with a C and E. You'd end up putting a C and E in and one time of the year, and then putting in this and another time. I don't know whether those can be both tied together.
There's some way that this should be staggered so that there's a continuity to it. We're talking about making stuff. But I really distrust the board where everybody's doing this.
Oh, and are you on the reporting or the committee? Or
on the 18th.
Oh, okay. I've stated my feeling that I think that I'm looking really at probably one of the most significant agencies or boards that Oregon has, and maybe we're giving them too much, but they'd be the governing board of the Fair Practices Commission. And they would have the legislative or the public official ethics. They would have CNE. They'd have lobbying. And I'm hopeful that we can pass Tony Meeker's and several others fair campaign practices. They'd have that as well, which would probably be one of the worst commissions to serve on of any state of Oregon, but probably one of the most important. And
so this part ought to be rewritten.
Right? Oh yeah, that'd be totally rewritten. And the guidelines I'd like to see would be. I have no objection to having them be appointed in the manner that we're talking about, one by the governor and one by each caucus of the party. But I don't want, as this says, no public official shall be appointed. And I really don't think we want judges or legislators or regulatory agencies or anybody else serving us. I think we can borrow from former legislators. I think Wilner did, certainly as an example of somebody who knows.
Yeah, but we won't be doing. Well, yes, we do. We'll have each house appointing one and a.
Each house appointing two.
Two.
In effect,
yeah.
Party
but they should be fixed some way so they're staggered.
I would
and
agree.
The governor, so that there would be. We could have the terms go 4 years. You could have the terms go 4 years and each.
Each one appointing one every 2 years. The commission on page 8, the commission shall close the system to fire with the Secretary of State or report concerning the action taken in the entire duty to honor duty to deploy. It seemed to me we would eliminate that. It seems that they are, in fact, a division of the Secretary of State, that they would then come under the requirement of the Secretary of State both report to him and in turn to the legislature during budget time. So I don't think there's any need to
eliminate this.
Now, in other words, we've created a State Fair Practices Division of the Secretary of State's office, and then we have in that appointed members appointed by the legislature and the governor and
whatever hired personnel they have to come out of their office.
In regard to that, I'm increasing the funding, I realize, but in that we've added their duties substantially, would it be wise to increase the membership to 7 or 9? What I'm thinking about is they very well may want to appoint substitutes. One of the failures of the Fair Campaign Practices is the fact that during the last 2 weeks, what it's designed to envision is when I complain about you're saying naughty things about me and my campaign, I don't know where to go. You know, I go to the press and you're saying naughty things. If we had a Fair Campaign Practices Act, which we don't have yet, but there is a bill, a decision has been rendered, much like the Secretary of State renders decisions on the ad during the ballot. This is good, this is bad. He has authority to jerk them off, but he got pretty good cooperation. Once he said this is good, this is bad, they would jerk. I would think it's a fair campaign. But if you're thinking that there are five individuals, and they've got to serve in charge of their charge of lobbying, exposure, conflict of interest, campaign expenditures, and fair campaign. I think we're talking about pretty sized staffing, but I'd be willing to go away and make some versions of staffing. Maybe by going to nine and having subcommittees might take some of the things. It just seems to me that I like small committees too, but we've really added to the duties. And I think wiser stuff. I think we're collecting the responsibility in one area where we all know where to go. But I think we might consider raising the, we're now at five, raising at least to seven, and perhaps nine.
I think that's a good idea. Nine.
Okay. If we go nine, then the question is, what's the balance? Earl pointed out that perhaps we ought to have one from the majority party in the House, one from the minority party in the House, and one from the minority-majority party in the House. But that's three in the House. We might do that in the Senate as well. But we have a balance. The thing might be, if we would leave it the way it is, and then pick up somebody nominated by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, which we pick up their judicial function, if you will, some super judge or something that would be able to be appointed there. Three more.
And Mr. Chairman, I think that there was, I'm not sure if we've dealt with it, but I think that there should be some right to be represented by legal counsel.
I think that ought to be a budget thing, but I would agree with you. And that's right. That we're fighting now between. That's
a real problem, yeah.
Would you go to the Secretary of State for legal advice, or would you go to the Attorney General?
Well, I think, well, my point is, I think that if I go to that commission,